Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Victory Over Self Radio. Victory Over Self, a podcast that dives into all things athletics. And today, we have, I'm going to announce him as the self-declared strength and conditioning Twitter moderator and frequent poster. We're going to call him the godfather of the field. If you're listening in, somebody that you've either heard of or you steal his stuff and call it your own. That's how original and that's how long Mike Boyle has been in the field. Coach Mike Boyle, thank you so much for coming on the show. We're super grateful.
No problem. Thanks for having me. I said I love to do this. I enjoy these hour-long conversations with other coaches, so looking forward to it. Awesome.
Good. So, Coach, have you ever heard the term OG? It's kind of thrown around a lot for you. And then if you have, do you know what the G stands for?
I believe it's original gangster, is it not? Am I correct on that one?
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And I'm going to focus in on that word gangster real quick because I grew up in northern New Jersey. I have we're going to call them associates that have attended the university, which you attended, Springfield College. And let's just say they would call the surrounding areas a little rough and tumble. So if you made it through, I'm going to guess even back in the day, you were putting the G in gangster. Am I a little right in that assumption?
It was a tough neighborhood, even at that time. It is a tougher neighborhood now, but it was clearly Springfield is a little island that kind of sits in the middle of this, not necessarily best part of Springfield. So it was, but now I think I wouldn't live where I lived. Let's put it that way. Where I lived in graduate school, I would not recommend that anybody live today if they went to Springfield College. I can say that much.
Okay, perfect. I appreciate that. And then a couple of years ago, we'll just call this the natural evolution or metamorphosis of people in this field. Saw Gray Cook stuff, wrote it off. This guy's a pansy. Years later, bunch of athletes get hurt, and I go, all right, this guy was probably right. Same thing, discover your stuff, single leg squat. That's for soft, weak people. Bunch of athletes get hurt years later, and I go, oof, okay, I think this guy was right. So do you keep a running tally? Do you keep a list monthly or weekly of how many people eventually reach out to you and go like, hey, Mike, I was a little harsh on you, and turns out you were right.
Yes, because I love that list. And I call it I used to think Mike Boyle was a pussy club because there's a lot of guys in that club who used to make fun of me. And then exactly like you, some guys got hurt. And then they start looking and thinking, wow, maybe this pussy that I was making fun of all these years has something to offer. And that's, it's an interesting thing because it is literally the story of my life in terms of I was you, I was everybody else. And I try to, every time I do talks, I try to explain that to people in terms of I was your regular old meathead powerlifter, had West Side, you know, I was an original West Side guy. So I was West Side before Louis, you know, West Side was originally in California and that was a name that they co-opted in Ohio. But I was following the original West Side guys, Roger Estep and George Friend and those guys and doing, we were box squatting. That's why I tell everybody, box squat is the stupidest exercise you could conceivably do. If you said, invent something incredibly dumb, I would say, compress your spine between two immovable objects. That would be as stupid as you could get in the weight room. And people get like, oh my God, I can't believe he said that. Louis, poor Louis, you know, he's speaking ill of the dead. But I literally have a picture of a can crusher operating in my presentations now. And I explain, this is box squatting, right? If you want to crush a beer can, you put it in something, you go, you just put, you fix the, you put the bottom against something and then you slam down on the top. And eventually people come around. People, I love people who say, oh, you know, it's the best exercise, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, it's the best exercise right up until the moment that it's not. And then you end up with either pain down your legs or this mushy SI joint or whatever it is that you get from doing it. And then suddenly you think, oh, that was a bad idea. And I tell people all the time, if I said, put your hand on the table and I'm going to pile 500 pounds on it, you'd be like, oh, no way. That's stupid. Why are you going to do that? And I look and say, well, what do you think has got more value actually, your hand or your spine? And most people would think, oh, my spine's got way more nerves. You know, it's affecting much more. I said, well, why would you do that? Why would you pile 500 pounds on it and then put something? I had someone once tell me it wasn't two immovable objects because the bar was movable. That was one person's argument. I said, your knowledge of physics is limited at best in terms of gravity and gravitational forces, but good attempted argument. But I just keep kind of plugging away and keep trying to explain to people that, hey, these are the mistakes that I've made. These are things that I did when I was in my 20s. These are things that I stopped doing when I was maybe in my 30s. And here's why we do what we do now. But I have a huge advantage. I have legitimately 40 years of doing this. And some of it, 17 years of it at different points in time, were training the exact same people. So I had this kid, Jay Pandolfo, who's now the hockey coach at Boston University. I actually trained for 17 years. I trained from the time he was 18 years old. He retired, I think, when he was 35 from the New Jersey Devils. And when you train somebody over 17 years, you see what happens to their body in the course of this time in professional sports. And Jay was probably the naturally strongest 17-year-old I ever saw. He might even have been a 17-year-old freshman, but he was definitely an 18-year-old freshman. Could bench press 300 pounds as a freshman coming in, high school kid. Wow. Was really just genetically gifted. Mm-hmm. By the time he was done at 35, we did not squat clean or bench press. So all of the major things that we had kind of built our workout around were no longer in the workout. We were doing one leg squats and dumbbell bench press, and I don't know what we were doing from a power development standpoint, but it certainly wasn't hang cleans anymore. And that's, as you live through that process with people and realize what you're doing to have them be able to go back and continue to play, you get smarter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for me, I operate in an extremely unique college hockey setting where we're not NCAA, we compete in the ACHA. So I just finished coaching this season my, I think, 8th hockey player who's played for 6 years here at Liberty. And it's kind of the same thing across those 6 years. It's just unbelievable how the body changes. And yeah, it's a huge advantage when you have those long-term athletes and you could really see the game, the practices, and the training off ice and how it just impacts and affects people.
So many coaches themselves didn't play for very long. And very much they reflect what they've done themselves in training, but they don't have all the additional stressors that the actual players have. So it's really easy to say, oh, you should do this or you should do that. And that's why I always look at people and think, kind of, what's your background? And some people always say, oh, you always fall back on that, on your experience, or on this, that. Like, of course I do. That's what I have. That's what I would fall back on naturally. But it's amazing to watch or to listen to people talk about things and you think you really don't have any idea what you're talking about. None. But that's our field. People who have no idea what they're talking about. If they talk about it enough, often enough, other people will perceive them as experts and will eventually begin to quote them. So that's why I'm the Twitter moderator, because I have to every once in a while throw it out there on Twitter, like, in a polite way, that's bullshit. Okay. That polite way. That's not accurate. And it offends people, I think, sometimes. And I've had people call me, people have private messaged me and said, you know, you're a bully, you embarrass people here. And I'm like, I'm not a bully and I'm not embarrassing people, but I will comment if you say something that I don't agree with. Because I always say social media is like a game where if you don't expect people to respond, then don't play the game. You shouldn't go on Twitter and post and then be offended when somebody posts back, oh, I didn't agree with that statement. That's the nature of the whole interaction. If every statement is just applause and clapping hand emojis and things like that, then we're all going to be experts forever because no one's ever going to disagree with us. And I just don't think I view social media as a learning process, both for me and for other people. And I think if you're not honest on social media, then you're not really actively participating in the learning process.
I think so much of social media is like prime examples of the Dunning-Kruger effect, where people are putting out content so early on because they want to get started in it. And this is where I kind of struggle with it is I don't feel like I'm ready to post stuff on social media. Like, yeah, I know I've been in this for a while now and I feel like I could, but I don't have enough confidence. One, two, I feel like I don't want to copy everybody else, but three, I don't want to like put something out there that, you know, maybe a year from now, I'm going to change my mind. Now, that's going to happen eventually anyways, but.
Yeah. And I think there's kind of two sides to that in terms of, I've had people say, you know, how do you get active on social media? And I said, sometimes it's just simply starting an account, following people and commenting, hey, great idea, or I agree, and not being controversial. I don't think you need to be a content creator in the beginning. And then I think when you do start to create content, starting to say, this has been my experience, and posing things more as questions. Hey, what do you think? We did this. What do you think? Versus the problem I get into is when people post absolutes and then get offended when you say, okay, I don't agree with your absolute. Somebody the other day, there's always people trying to kind of shift towards the aerobic zone 2 thing. And somebody said, volume is the way to injury avoidance or something like that. And I said, no, it's not. It's definitely not. Particularly in field and court sports. And then he came back and said, oh, I was just talking about lower leg. And I said, okay, if you were just talking about lower leg, you had more than enough characters left to say lower leg. But it's amazing when sometimes you question, challenge, whatever, then people go back and say, oh, well, this is what I meant. And I always think the good thing about social media is you should try really hard to have your post say what you mean. I sit with mine and I read and I reread them. I sometimes write them really long and then try to shorten, whether it's cutting out words or abbreviating words, whatever I have to do to make the post fit. But that's generally what I'll do. But I want to try to make sure that I get the point across and that I don't leave things maybe open-ended or ambiguous or however you want to look at it. So I think some of it is it's sort of like getting into the game. You can go and listen to music. You don't necessarily have to play music. And in much the same way, you can participate on Twitter and, you know, or Instagram or whatever it is and say, hey, this is what we did today. What do you think? And then you got to put your thick skin on. If somebody said, hey, that was great, but this could be better, or gee, I didn't like that technique, you just have to be ready for the comments to sometimes not be great. I still regularly get people who hate the way that we do things, whether it's the way that we clean or whatever. I post stuff because I tell people I post what we actually do. I don't try to post any sanitized version of what we do. And people will make comments. Oh, they kind of bounce a little off the pad on the squat. And I'm like, yeah, I use one of my son all the time. And I'm thinking he was trying to one leg squat 80 for 5. Absolutely. Bounced a couple times. No question. Mm-hmm. But that's what's, you're not, sometimes you're, your limit attempts aren't going to be perfect attempts, and you just have to acknowledge that. But I always try to preemptively lay that out there. Like, hey, I know this isn't perfect, not posting this as a technique video. This is not a technique tutorial, something like that. I think allows you to kind of, hey, I've entered the chat. I'm here. This is what I think. This is what we're doing, without kind of puffing your chest out. Cause I get offended more with people who are trying to misrepresent themselves. Like you said, Dunning-Kruger, people are trying to misrepresent themselves as experts who clearly aren't. And that's massive. That's when Chris was saying, is there anything you can ask? The only thing you can't ask is to me to name names, because I try to not do that. But there's some incredible frauds on social media. People who are, I would name names and you guys would go like, serious? And I'm like, yeah, absolute total frauds. Don't coach anybody. Never really accomplished anything except to be good on social media. That's what they do. I think we don't do, we meaning collectively in the field, a good enough job vetting people on social media and looking at this and saying, wait a second, what about this guy? What does he actually do? Because it's amazing how people will, I always think, people will kind of stretch their resume. Oh, I've coached people from Major League Baseball, the NFL, blah, 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 you know, NHL. And then you realize some of those people, it might literally have been one of each of those, and that's it. And it might have been one workout or two workouts. And it's just amazing how people pad the resume and nobody ever peeks behind the curtain.
I had a friend whose brother played 2 seasons in the NFL, and he showed up at Liberty just to work out one day. He was in the same weight room as me, and everyone's like, oh, you trained an NFL guy. I was like, no, I didn't. Like, he was just there. He just kind of showed up. I'm not going to try to promote that or put that on my resume or anything like that. He was just there. So I definitely agree. It kind of happens there.
Right, exactly. We have the brother of one of our kids is going to go in the first round. And he's been in the gym a bunch of times and worked out. If someone said, did you train him? I would say, no, I've never trained him. I've let him come in with his brother and work out when he was home on break. But I wouldn't throw him on my client list. I wouldn't put his jersey up on our wall, those kind of things. And we don't. I mean, anybody, if you come in and look at our wall, with one or two exceptions that are specific, everybody whose jersey is up there because they trained there. And they trained there for an off season at least, minimally. And most of them were multiple off seasons.
And I think something that draws a lot of people to you, Coach, is like, seemingly, you're doing it right and you've been doing it right for so long. So long-winded-ish story here. July 1, 2014, my first day on the job here at Liberty, I have no idea what I'm doing. And I literally Google strength coach. And sure enough, what pops up first, strengthcoach.com. Oh, perfect. And so I joined the site. I start reading articles. I purchased resources, books, and it just helped out so much. So first and foremost, if I don't get the time later on, just want to say thank you for impacting me, mentoring me, and the other thousands of coaches, which in turn at this point, hundreds of thousands of athletes that you've kind of coached and helped. But going along those lines, you've put out tons of content. All right. We've talked social media, but articles on your sites, other articles, you've put clips of presentations, we'll call them in services at your facilities, books. Blair has a VHS tape that you released, we'll just say a couple years ago. I'm extremely drawn to people who are able to put their thoughts and ideas down on a piece of paper and kind of have the balls to put it out there, such as yourself. Can you please, to the best that you can, sort of describe the process of Human Kinetics calls you and they say, Mike, we want you to write a book on functional training. We think what you do is functional training. Are you going back and forth weekly, monthly with editors? Are you coming up with all the chapters? Are you handwriting this stuff? Do you voice record it and transcribe it? Are you typing on a computer? I'm super interested in your
personal. So I'm typing on a computer. I'm coming up primarily with most of the chapters. They had some outline ideas in their mind. They did say things like, we want you to find somebody to write a foreword. We need a preface. And then there were times when I would send them things and they say, well, we need a chapter on this. They wanted a chapter on testing, which I didn't really want to write. So I kind of had to figure out, okay, if I was going to write about testing, what would I write? So there was a little back and forth, but the vast majority of it was just a little bit James Joyce, you know, a little stream of consciousness, just kind of spitting stuff out. Because I started, actually, this is how stupid I was at the time. I have to look up Ed's name. Ed was the acquisitions editor. So he's the guy who tries to get you to write the book. It was a long time ago. It was 2003 or two or something. So I guess I can be okay with not remembering his last name. But, he said, hey, we want you to write a book. And I was like, how long is a book? And he's like, what do you mean? I said, if you're going to give me a word count, how many words would a book be? And for whatever reason, he said 45,000 would be about a ballpark. So I pulled all my articles that I'd written previously. I'd written for training and conditioning. I'd written a bunch of stuff. I'd written some little manuals that perform better sold, like training the posterior chain or whatever you called it, hamstring training. I don't know what you even called it at that time. But I just pulled all that into one Word document and I had 27,000 words. And I thought, easy. I write like 18,000 more words. And I just sat down and said, okay, I'm going to try to write 500 words a day that will fill into either create one of these chapters or fill in one of these chapters or whatever it is. So I think, and go back to kind of what Blair was talking about, it's, I am not a Nike guy at all, but I do love the Just Do It idea. I think you need to do it, whether it's speaking, whether it's writing, no matter what it is, you will not get better at it if you don't do it. Mm. And you just have to do it with some respect for the process, I think, in terms of whether it's whatever type of content you're trying to create, whether it's Instagram content or deciding to write articles. I think there's a lot to be said for writing, even though most people aren't reading what you're writing anymore. It's a really good way to organize your thought process. And I think even what I realized, I started filming lectures. Functional Strength Coach series came out of this series. I forget the name of it, but somebody did this seminar in Arizona, and my friend Alan Cosgrove was one of the speakers, and it was a bunch of people that were kind of popular at that time who got together in Arizona, and six of them did a seminar, and I think they probably did two one-hour lectures a piece, and I bought it, much like Blair. It was on VHS, Blair. I don't know where you got a hold of VHS. You must have got it from your father or somebody, but you still managed to get a hold of it. But at that time, what I realized is it was just these guys lecturing to a room full of people, and somebody was recording it. And before that, I had actually made some VHS tapes for Perform Better, probably what Blair saw, that were more kind of instructional studio kind of thing. Not really studio, but we went in the weight room on a Sunday and we filmed content with the idea that it would be edited down and made into sort of instructional videos. And then I started to think, I can just record my lectures and sell them. That's crazy. And so I decided to do functional strength coach. I said, I'm going to do functional strength coach. And I talked to Ryan Lee, who was a friend of mine who was really good at internet marketing. And I said, hey, you want a partner on this thing? He said, I'll do it. I'll record it. All you got to do is figure out how to sell it. And we both made a significant amount of money in, you know, the space of about a month. Because that was the internet products, they kind of come and go. You make money and then it's over. They don't have much shelf life, but you can make money doing it. But then I realized, wow, this is an amazing way to get information out. So we did. I mean, I think we're up to the next one we'll do when I do it. If I decide to do it, it'll be Functional Strength Coach 8. Wow. But we just got a bunch of people together for a seminar, and we'd actually sell whatever ticket seats at the seminar to cover our expenses. So the worst case scenario was that if you don't make any money, you didn't lose any money. So you just find a place to do it. You speak, you record it, you throw it out there on the internet. If people buy it, and people bought it. I mean, Functional Strength Coach, we, over the years, over seven, we made a lot of money on Functional Strength Coach. But it wasn't, and I think that's the problem with people always say, oh, it's about clicks, it's about money. It was never about clicks or about money. It was about getting information out. And hey, maybe somebody will buy this. I didn't have any expectation that it was going to be a portion of my income, or that books would be a portion of my income, or any of those things. It was just more a matter of, I'm going to get my ideas out there because I got all these ideas. I got stuff bouncing around in my head. I might as well get it out so that a wider audience can perceive that. And I think at some points I was looking at some of the content out there and thinking, there's a lot of content out there that's not as good as what we're doing. But Ryan Lee was really helpful to me, because Ryan used to always say stuff like, if you think your stuff is good, why are you so embarrassed to put it out there? Why are you afraid of selling it? Why do you care if someone cares about you making money? He said, "Where you guys are the only industry where you're embarrassed about making money. If you make money, like, it makes you a bad guy. Like, oh, you're trying to make money at your job. You're a bad guy. Like, you shouldn't do that." And I started to realize, yeah, he's right. If my information is good, why shouldn't people buy it? And if it's helping them to become a better coach, why shouldn't they buy it? And why shouldn't I sell it? And why shouldn't I at some point benefit from it? All that is effectively what any other businessman with half a brain is doing every moment of every day, whether it's selling cars or computers or whatever. People have no problem attaching themselves to a product and then becoming a salesman for that product. But for us, we're supposed to be some sort of monk-like vow of poverty, where we've decided that it's all about the kids, and all we're really supposed to do, we're supposed to get a meager salary that'll barely feed our family. We'll never buy a house. We'll never own a house. And we'll still be a slave to the system. And I kind of looked at it and thought, why can't I be a well-off strength coach? Why is that an oxymoronic sort of idea?
So you don't have to go.
We just kept pushing.
Yeah, sorry. You don't have to go into crazy detail, but for anyone who's discovering you right now and they haven't done their homework, so to speak, you've had, while being a strength coach, multiple other jobs all wrapped up in there too, right? Like, do you like flip houses with your family? You were tending.
Yep. Bars. My wife and I have been flipping houses for 30 years. We've probably lived in, I don't know, 30, at least 30 houses, maybe 40 houses, honestly. So I can hang a little sheetrock. I can put a floor in. I can do basic carpentry skills. I wouldn't call myself a skilled carpenter, but I can do most things that need to be done. And, I was a bartender until I was 30, and I didn't have, the first time I had one job, I was 52 years old. I quit the Red Sox after 2 years at the Red Sox. And prior to that, I had been at BU and had my own business for 12 or 14 years. And prior to that, for 10 years, I was at BU and worked for the Bruins for 9 or 10 seasons. And then prior to that, I was working at BU almost as a volunteer. I don't even think it was full time, and I was a bartender. So I have always never been afraid of working.
So, Coach, hold on. I know you were with the Red Sox for a short period of time. Mm. You came in. They stunk. Then they won a World Series the next year, right?
Yes.
Did you leave right after the World Series?
I left right after the World Series. I realized that it was go out on a high point. And it, honestly, I wouldn't even have done it except that it was the Red Sox. It was an opportunity. And I had really wanted to try my hand at pro sports with an opportunity to succeed. The Bruins in the 90s was not an opportunity to succeed because they wanted a part-time strength coach. They didn't want to put any money into it. They really weren't committed to the process at all. Whereas with the Red Sox, I feel like a good strength coach makes a difference in professional sports. And I just wanted to validate that in my own head for no other reason. And I got there in my first year. If I made a difference, it was a bad one because we were last. But the next year we won the World Series. So I was able to walk away with a World Series ring after 2 years. And I have friends who have been in baseball for 20 years and have never won a World Series. Some of that is luck. I will positively admit that. But I do think a good strength and conditioning program contributes to your development, particularly in baseball is a really good example because you've got such an extensive minor league organization. You have literally hundreds of players. More than any other sport. It's much, the closest thing I could relate it to when I was there was college football. In terms of you're there at spring training and you've got, I don't know, 140 or 180 or something people there that are going to train.
Wow.
And one of the things that we did right off the bat is I said, we're going to have a training system. And everybody knew it. And we had a whole bunch of strength coaches at each level. I had our major league guy was the guy who had been our minor league guy, and our minor league guy became one of our minor league guys became our minor league coordinator. And we had a bunch of really good young guys. And I just said, hey, this is the way we're going to do it. We're going to have one system. Everybody's going to roll. Everybody's going to stretch. Everybody's going to do the workouts exactly the way that we think the workouts, the way really I think the workouts should be done. And we're all going to be kind of conscientious and loyal. And if I find out that you're down in, you know, Greenville or whatever, and guys are back squatting, then you're going to have a problem. But our guys were great. Everybody got on board and we had a really, really good system. We had great systems with our minor league guys getting through. Our major league guys really liked what we were doing. It was very seamless for guys to move from organization to organization. So I think in some ways, at least we put in a system that was helpful. And we were able to have a really good impact on the major league guys that we have. Most importantly, though, they brought in that second year, they brought in some really good guys. They brought in David Ross and Ryan Dempster and Jake Peavy. I mean, Shane Victorino, Mike Napoli. They really went out and got some guys that really loved baseball and really wanted to win, which I think sometimes the focus can be too much on talent. And it's the combination of talent and character, I think, that gets you over the top. I don't think talent is always just the thing. You've got to have a little bit of both. And we had a lot of both. We had a lot of talent. And I always say to people when you rattle off the pitching staff that we had, that we had Jake Peavy and we had John Lester and we had John Lackey and we had Andrew Miller. And the year before we'd had Josh Beckett. I mean, we had, and our best pitcher was Koji Uehara, actually, who nobody remembers, but Koji Uehara was basically unhittable as a closer. And that year, and probably only that year, but he was in a situation where very few people got hits off Koji during that time. And like I said, we had two Japanese pitchers, we had Venezuelan pitchers, we had Mexican pitchers, we had people from all over the world. So it was a really cool opportunity, but just was not sustainable from a family standpoint. It was draining for me, and it wasn't a great kind of home life situation.
And I think that's a perfect transition because when we discussed having the opportunity to bring you on, yeah, I want to hear all about you know, your time with the Bruins, Boston, and Single Lake training and talk hockey. But at the same time, number one, I just wanted to hear, like, okay, you sit down on a computer, you just do it, you try to write 500 words a day when you're creating. And then along those lines too, Ross Blair and I all have young children, and your children are older now. They play sports at a high level. I fully intend on trying not to be, but will be a crazy dad of, you know, bringing my son into the weight room as soon as he could walk type of thing. Can you just share some of the experiences of being a dad? And as I'm kind of getting on the along those lines here, did a podcast with Anthony Donskov, Buddy Morris, Fergus Connolly, and Dan Pfaff, and you all kind of went around in roundtable form and just sort of discussed how the job took over and your marriage suffered. And thank you so much for that honesty. Like, as a younger coach in the field, it's super refreshing to hear of, like, no, put your family, put your marriage as a priority. So thank you there. Kind of a side note, but yeah, can you share some of those, like, successes, failures of what you would keep the same, do differently when it comes to training your own kids, and kind of just how it went and the overall experience?
It's interesting. My daughter, one thing you have to realize is that your kids are going to be really different, and accepting that part right off the bat can be easy or hard. I guess for me, it was easy. My daughter wanted to be around. She wanted to go everywhere with me and do everything with me. And she loved sports. She loved being around the guys. She loved being in the weight room. She, to the point where you had to tell her to, like, leave. I can always remember at BU during warmups, I'd be like, okay, you cannot, like, this is pregame. Okay. We're getting ready. You can't come out of the office. You stay in the office until we're done warming up. And I would look down there and her head would be like sticking out, looking at me. And I'd be like, back in, you know, I told you can't come out. But she would go in and talk to the guys. She got to go. Like, she had a much better experience than my son. The reason I started working with the national team again when they asked me was because of her. I thought, this is going to be unreal if I can take her to camps and she can get to kind of grow up around. I still remember that we went to the first meeting. I brought her and I told this woman Reagan Carey had hired me, and I said, I'm coming, I'm bringing my daughter. And she really wanted me to work, so I think she was just kind of like, okay, I'll take the luggage to get Mike to come out and do this. And we were out in Blaine, Minnesota, and Michaela's sitting there, and she said, what's your job? And she looked up, she goes, to be seen and not heard. And I was like, okay, she listened to what I said, because I literally said, you need to be seen and not heard. You need to stay out of the way. But my daughter is a very large personality person. Within 30 minutes, she is in the locker room. She's taping sticks. She's running errands for the girls. But she's literally having the time of her life. I mean, she's in there with, it's the Olympic team, and she's 12 years old. And the girls really embraced her. And for her, I always said, if you've ever read, I think it's Talent Code, where Coyle talks about ignition. Mm-hmm. That was her ignition moment. So I think one of the things you want to do is expose your kids to your athletes, expose your kids to your team. I think my daughter looked around and was like, oh my God, these are my people. Like, there's other big girls who like hockey. Like, I think, you know, in her social circle, she was an oddball. Mm-hmm. Cause she was a bigger kid who really loved sports. She was very intuitive as a kid. She would say things like, yeah, my friends aren't really into it. They're social hockey players. You know, I'm not a social hockey player. This is for real with me. I'm not just doing this to be on the team or to make friends. I'm doing this, you know, I want to play. Like, for her, she goes, I want to get, you know, I want a college scholarship. I want to play in the Olympics. This is what I want to do. I want to be like these girls that I see at these camps. And, so she had a great exposure. My son, it was very different. My son was a similar age when I worked for the Red Sox. I literally, one day I said, want to come into Fenway. And he's kind of like, I was like, come on, we're just going to go in. It was a rare off day. You don't have many off days in baseball. I said, we're going to go in, you know, Carl Crawford's going to work out. Jacoby Ellsbury's going to work out, to just be a couple of guys and like two all-stars, right? I mean, two guys that if you're a baseball fan, you're like, okay, I'm going to get to go meet Carl Crawford and Jacoby Ellsbury. He comes in and he proceeds to play video games in the clubhouse and eat everything that he can get his hands on. He can't believe, like, we have an ice cream. You guys have an ice cream machine. This is unbelievable. He pays zero attention to what's going on the field, as like could care less about Carl or Jacoby. Meets him like, yeah, how you doing? Good to see you. How do you work this game? You know, just a totally different person. And it was like, okay, he's not into it. The next week we had, because it was during the playoffs, we had two Monday off days. I said, you want to go back to Fenway? We can go play catch or whatever, you know, watch the guys. He's like, no, I'm going to stay home. I got my friends are going to play street hockey. And it was like, okay. So he's not the same. He's a really good athlete. He would have been a Division I lacrosse player, tore his ACL, and it's not one of these tore his ACL, never played again. Just tore his ACL, didn't want to go to prep school, was happy to go to a Division II school, but a good athlete, but just a totally different personality than the sister. And I think that's the biggest thing with your kids is just realizing, okay, who are they? What are they like? Can I support them in whatever it is they want to do? So you don't become that crazy dad who's maybe dragging some kid around to baseball who wants to stay home and draw pictures. You just got to know, okay, this is my kid. This is what my kid likes. I'm going to expose my kid to a lot of opportunities. We were really good about exposing our kids to multiple sports when they were little. My daughter, it was out of need. You had to find something to do with it, someplace to take her. I mean, we rock climbed, we did judo, we did gymnastics. Like I always used to say, I would take her to a rock fight if they'd let her participate. You know what I mean? Just because, okay. She was just that kind of kid that she would wear you out at every stage of your life. My son just wasn't that way. He was a lot more easygoing. And you weren't constantly thinking, how do I keep him engaged and entertained? And we probably had to, with him, I think sometimes some kids you push, some kids you pull. I was probably pulling my son and really gently pulling him along. Whereas my daughter, I was really pushing her because she was good and obviously much better than her peers at a really young age. And so I probably, some people would say I was a crazy dad because I would be super honest with her sometimes. I mean, I remember a game, she scored 4 goals and she came off and I was like, that was awful. You should be embarrassed. And she was looking like, I had 4 goals. And I was like, that was an embarrassing display. She literally was pointing at other kids to go get the puck. Like literally, you go over there, go in the corner, go. And I'm like, you told someone to go get you the puck so you could score. I said, that's the ultimate. And she was probably only 11. I was like, that's the ultimate in laziness. It's so embarrassing. Anybody that's watching, any coach that's watching the game would see you not wanting to compete for the puck and just score a goal. But I could have those conversations at 11 with her. And I probably couldn't have those at 11 with my son. He was more just keep encouraging him. Hey, I love watching, you know, kind of the, I love watching you play thing. I think that's a really good thing. If you just keep saying, I love watching you play, you're in a really good spot. And the other thing, truthfully, Ed, because you have young kids, play with your kids. Yeah. The first year I worked for the Red Sox, I sat down and I made a deal with myself that I was going to play with my son for 15 minutes whenever he asked, no matter how I felt. And sometimes, honestly, that involved me setting the timer on my phone in my pocket and going out and playing catch with a baseball for 15 minutes and thinking, I want to be laying on the couch right now. This is the last thing that I want to do. I'm going to work 100 hours this week. But I told myself I'm not. Like if he says, I want to go do blank, I am going to get my ass up off the couch and I am going to go do it for at least 15 minutes. And I think that makes a really big difference because it was funny. We had this older guy who lived across the street from us. And one day he comes walking out of his house with this big bag of baseballs. And he gives them to me. He said, I want you to have these. He said, you're the only guy on this street who plays with his kid. He goes, I've never seen anybody else on this street play with their kid except you. He said, and I know you'll take these balls and go down to the park and pitch with them, you know, pitch to them. Cause I know I've heard you say, you know, we're going to go down and pitch. So your ability to engage your kids in the early stages really makes a big difference. Because then I think, that's the time when they want your attention. You'll get to a point, like you're at the point where I'm at, like with my son, he's a 19-year-old boy, doesn't want nor need much attention. And you realize, wow, it's, you won't know that it's over until it's too late.
Oh no.
I remember once reading something that said, don't ever kick your kid out of your bed because the last time they sleep in your bed will be the last time and you won't know it. Yeah. And I remember thinking, yeah, they're right. If they want to sleep and if they want to come in and sleep with us when they're 12 years old, good. I don't care. I'm not worrying about it. I never worried about what anybody else said. And then even when you get to the whole sports thing, I'm never going to worry about what anybody said. We did the exact opposite of what everybody did. With like my daughter, clearly the best hockey player in our area, and I would not let her play in the summer. Mm. And people would ask, well, what about, you know, is she going to go and do this tournament? Is she going to do this? I'm like, nope.
not going to do any of that. And then you get all the, oh, she's going to fall behind, you know? And I was like, pretty sure when September comes, she'll still be better than everybody else that's out there. And she would. She'd go and she'd swim. Like she was, I listened, she did a podcast the other day in Minnesota, and she talked about the fact one summer she took up diving. Wow. Because we used to take her to the pool, and there was like a little, you know, country club kind of swim team thing, but they had divers. And she would just be throwing herself off the diving board, you know, doing cartwheels off the diving board and throwing herself backwards off the diving board. And the guy came up to her and was like, you know, do you want to learn how to dive? And she was like, yeah, probably. You know, we need a U12 diver. She was like, oh, I can do that. Crazy. And she won that summer. She won the U12 diving thing, you know, and it's a country, you know, it's not a big deal, but it was just continued exposure to all of these activities. Then my wife's sitting right here. The other thing I would tell you, don't like, you know, have date night, set aside time. Don't get yourself in a situation. I was in a situation where I thought, and this was before we had kids, where I thought that I was a great provider and that I was building a great life for my family. And my wife was miserable because I was never home. And she would say things like, I don't see you when you're awake. And like I said, if you heard the Anthony Donskoff thing, you know, she kind of gave me the ultimatum. You go to marriage counseling or I go. And thank God she did. And thank God we went. So, you know, you just have to realize, I mean, and I was one of those people, the Boyles don't do counseling. That was definitely not in my, not in my family tree, but I realized I did want to stay married and I did love my wife. So I went.
Coach, did you ever find it difficult shifting from Coach Boyle to home life? Were you the same person in both places? I have a daughter who's six. She just started playing hockey, and I'm kind of walking the line of being the hockey dad and not so much a hockey coach, trying to stay on the sidelines there.
Well, one, I never coached the kids. I didn't coach them until they were old enough to come in the gym. And then I started coaching them. And even then I coached them in the beginning. And then later on, I would almost always have somebody else with me coaching them so that somebody else could kind of play the bad cop role a little bit more. So I could just be, I tried to stay in the dad role as much as I could. As I said, with my daughter more, I would get out of it sometimes and get into coach mode. And that's maybe why she is coaching and wants to be a coach. And she's actually real good at coaching because I would be honest. But like I said, my son was just a different person, and I needed to encourage him more. I needed to pull him along more so that he didn't get to the point where he thought, I don't really want to do this because you're making it not fun. And that's the part that I think is critical. When you look at it and think, if you're making it not fun, then you're the problem. Mm. With my daughter, I was very hard on her. It honestly didn't change her at all. She was very driven. She was one of these kids who she would keep her, she'd play a U10 game or a U12 game, keep all her equipment on and say, the U14s aren't going to have enough kids. And I was like, are you sure? She's like, no, but I don't think they are. And they're going to let me play. And literally, we'd leave her at the rink. She'd play 3-4 games in a row. She played, when she was 12, she played in U19 games. The U19 kids, because she was good, the U19 kids would let her play. And they'd be like, yeah, we only have two lines. And she would always be like, you know, I'm still here. I'm still dressed. I got my skates on. I'm ready to go. And she'd like text on her phone, I'm going to play in the U19 game with so-and-so. And we'd be like, okay, we'll come down and watch the U19 game. And it actually ended up being good because she really surfed ability levels a lot in terms of she, you know, her age group game, she was super dominant. And then, you know, when you're 12 or 13 in a U19 game, you're chasing everybody around, you know, like a bat out of hell, just trying to keep up and hope maybe you can get your stick on a puck and score a goal kind of thing. So she kind of learned the effort part sometimes playing with older kids. And I think that's something that we don't get to do enough. And it can be bad. Like if you're constantly moving your kid up to play against better kids, then they don't get to excel. But if you're occasionally letting them play with older kids, then they do. Kevin Neal, who's now the Bruins strength coach, I remember he told me one time, he said, your kid should be one of the best five players on their team. And I thought, that's like with my son. And my son ended up being a really good high school hockey player, better lacrosse player, but a good high school hockey player. But he wasn't, you know, on some of the teams that he could have been on, he wouldn't have been one of the best five players. So we would we had him on other teams. He sometimes was on a lower level team, but he was always able to be a good offensive player. And he developed into a real good offensive player from not being kind of typecast. Sometimes if you're on the top team, you can end up being a checker when you're 12. You know, someone says, oh, you know, you're a third, fourth line grinder. And I'm like, no, and go and play on the twos and be the first line center. His freshman year, he didn't make the varsity team. He ended up being he was the last kid cut, ended up making the JV team, and he was devastated because his other buddy, Bade, was the only two freshmen were in the mix to make it, or three. Two of them, his two other friends made it, he didn't. And it was the best thing that happened to him because he played JV, and he was the first line center on the JV team, and he scored a bunch of goals. He played in every game. He played a ton. It made him a way better player the next 3 years. So I think sometimes you also have to be ready to kind of deal with disappointment and not kind of take your ball and go home kind of dad, like, okay, we're going to go to a different team. Or even sometimes just being ready to say, hey, I'm okay being on the twos. I'm okay not being in the best situation, because the best quote unquote situation may not be the best situation for your kid.
That's good advice. No, that's a really good point. And how beautiful too for women's hockey of obviously it's going to be more physical as they get older, but without the body checking, like, you know, a 12, 13 year old boy, unless they are absolute monsters playing U18, they probably get roughhoused a little bit in the corner.
Right, exactly. They couldn't. That's the thing. You couldn't do it at the boys level, but at the girls you could. But my daughter, like her U12 year, she played boys.
Yeah.
She was like, she's just like, the girls, you know, it's not good enough. I want to play. I'm going to play boys.
And those are the girls we love recruiting here. When you get those small town, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta girls who played, you know, guy hockey their whole life, they're just a different breed. Once you get them.
Yep, they are. They're much more a girl who's had a good sampling of men's hockey. Yeah, and again, that's to talk about parenting. I was dead set against that early on. The girls should be playing with the girls because it's going to be a different game and it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be the same. And then later on, I let her do it and I realized, oh, a year of this and maybe one more year would have been good. But it was funny, the next year with her, she didn't like being on the boys team because the boys excluded her in terms of the 12-year-old boys didn't want to hang around with the 12-year-old girl. So she wanted to be on a girls team and have more friends that were girls. Actually, it was 11-year-old year she played with the boys because her 12-year-old year, she went and tried out for a select team, and the U12s weren't very good. And we said, we're going to go back. We'll play another year of boys and U12. And then the coach, you know, again, because it was girls, the coach intelligently said, I'll let her play U14 then if she wants. If she doesn't want to play U12, she can play U14, even though she was 12. And they let her play U14, which ended up being about, you know, she was where she needed to be.
And so, coaches, we're kind of wrapping things up here. We've mentioned, you know, within your career, within, you know, raising your kids, just multiple different levels and stuff like that. And Ross was kind of wondering of, you know, some of the differences you found, things like that. Ross, what was that question that you had?
Yeah, coach. So between, you know, you work professional, you work college, and obviously you work with high school athletes privately. What has been your general approach and kind of mindset with those different levels? You know, when I'm working with the youth, working with the college, high school, and as to get the professional, just general mindset and approach as you've handled that population.
Well, it's interesting. Like the younger kids, when they're in the private sector, are really there because they want to be there. So you can't be the same kind of coach. I used to sometimes look at my son and think, if this was college, I would kill you guys. We would be in the back right now, riding the bikes until we threw up. And instead I'm here trying to kind of cajole guys into doing what they're supposed to be doing because they could just not come if they didn't want to come. So if I want these kids to be there and get better, I have to treat them a certain way. I can't be a hard ass kind of coach. College, you can be the ultimate hard ass and just get away with it, particularly with boys. And it's just, everybody's pretty much a prisoner and they got to do what you say. And a lot of times you've got, again, 18 to 21 year old boys, they really want to get better. You can be really hard on them. You can swear at them. You can scream, raise your voice, do whatever. College girls can't do that. College girls, women in general, if women don't think that you like them, they're going to shut you out really, really quickly. They need to feel valued in a way that boys don't. Boys just, some of them just don't care. If you don't like them, they're like, who gives a fuck? I don't care if you like me. I don't like you either. And that's not going to change one iota of what I'm doing here or what I'm trying to do on the ice or whatever on the field. it won't make any difference. Whereas some females will be deeply offended and just stop trying. So it's a very different kind of manner of motivation. I was just talking to my daughter about this today. Anson Dorrance wrote a book called Training Soccer Champions. And if you're not familiar with who Anson Dorrance is, you should get your head out of your ass. But he won like 24 national championships or something in women's soccer. Not talking to you guys collectively, but to the listeners. But Training Soccer Champions is probably the best book ever written on coaching females, because he's really made an art out of how to coach female athletes. And then the pros is completely different, because it goes the exact opposite way of college. You can't bully those guys at all, because they're just going to look at you and be like, fuck you. I make more money than you. I'll be here when you're gone. If it comes down to you or me, it's definitely going to be me. So don't. And you realize that. So sometimes that's where a lot of guys fail when they come from college to the pros, is they think you can treat pros like you treat college guys. College guys are just, and it's changing now, NIL, portal, all this stuff. College is going to be very different in the next 5 years. But up to this point, college, you could kind of bully guys. If you were a big looking, strong, loud guy, you could kind of impose your will on the group. At the pro level, they could care less. They don't care what you look like. They only care what you know. And there, it's a very, very different dynamic. You are shifted unintentionally more into a sales kind of mode, where you got to get guys to believe in you. You got to get guys to want to do what you want them to do. And that's actually what I'm good at. I think that's why I had as much success as I did in the pros, because I could always get guys to do what I wanted them to do. I always used to look at guys and think, hey, you were here before me. You got here without me. I get it. You know, anybody, if you're in a pro locker room, like, okay, this guy's a professional athlete, which means he is the elite of the elite, whether his work ethic is, whether his weight room technique is, none of that matters. He's a professional athlete. He's here. He made the team. He's playing. You better figure out a way to get him to be engaged and to do the things that you want to do. So there is some ability that you've got to be kind of a little bit of a surfer if you're going to do it across multiple, I guess, domains. When you start thinking about high school, private sector, college, professional. And because I didn't think professional hockey and professional baseball were very different, really. It was still the same kind of thing. You can figure out who you have, kind of some alphas in the room. You have some guys who are just trying to hang on. It was to me very, very similar dynamics and environment. And I was very comfortable dropping right in there and being able to operate the way that I had always operated before, which was to just kind of get guys to buy in. And the difference too, and that's what you talk about, the single leg stuff, the functional stuff. A lot of these guys, they're smarter and they've been through the ringer a little bit, and they've probably had their share of bad training. Cause I always remember when I start seeing the guys, you're not going to have to squat. 90% of pro guys are like, high five, Mike, you're the man. You're not another one of these idiots who's going to like try to make me into an Olympic weightlifter or make me into a power lifter or whatever. You're just going to worry about me getting better at doing what I do and help me make more money. Perfect. And that's a lot of the places that I've been. It's really funny that that's what you realize, is that you don't, even with NFL guys, all the NFL guys that I have, sometimes guys will come in and first thing they'll do is start explaining to you about their injuries. And I've had some trouble with my back. And I'm like, you won't have any trouble with your back here. You know, I'll never make you do a back squat again. And guys literally look at me like, man, I love you. You know, you're not one of those dummies who's going to insist that I do heavy squats, because that's going to really make me a man. And, you know, some of those guys are like, I'm a man. Trust me. Yeah. I play in the NFL. Like, there aren't a lot of softies playing in the NFL. So being able to coach those guys from a respectful standpoint, and even be able to talk them out of it. I'd have some guys where I think, this isn't good for you. This is not what you need to be doing at this stage of your career. So it's different.
It's funny you say that, because I'm currently in Texas at a really big high school. And so I'm seeing like 500 high school kids a day, plus 300 to 400 middle school kids a day. And so we're seeing a ton of kids. And it's interesting, you made the comment of, you know, the ignition moment and getting kids around the right people, you know, get them in the right environment, or the, you know, you got some kids that are there for social reasons, which is totally fine. And you got to know, hey, this is the kid I can push and the team and the group and really adapt. And it's really interesting to see between your different teams, particularly at the high school. Okay. This is, this is the community and the team that they're about it, you know, and we're going to go for it. And you have the other teams that aren't, and that's okay. And currently what I battle a little bit with kids, and it happened today with a group, you know, we might be doing a squad and a kid will say, hey, this is kind of bothering my low back. I'm like, okay, well, you know, has your back been bothering you a little bit? It's like, well, I had a back injury last year. I'm like, okay, well, you got to tell me these things. Let's do something else. You know, I'm not married to that one movement. And that's something our kids are learning, is I couldn't care less if you can't do what I'm assigning. We'll just do something else and we'll adjust. So that's been something we've been trying to teach here. But great. Now that sounds good to me. I think Kerr has got a good question here for you, Coach, or Blair, whoever wants to go next. Sorry,
that I want. One is, and I think, I can't remember. Might have been Outliers, but I think it's Outliers. There's a chapter on Tom Martinez, who was a great quarterback coach. He was Brady's quarterback coach as a kid. And one of the things that he said, Ross, that related to what you were talking about, is he said, every kid's life is a mixture of shit and ice cream. If he's had too much shit, I got to mix in some ice cream. If he's had too much ice cream, I got to mix in some shit. And it's a part of it is like looking at a kid and realizing, okay, is this, am I at country club day school here where everybody's parents run a hedge fund or whatever, and this kid's life has been nothing but ice cream, and I might have to give him a little bit of shit, or am I at an inner city school where a lot of this kid's life has been shit, and I got to be the ice cream guy? And you've got to be able to figure that out from a balance standpoint. The other book that was really good is Kurt Hester's Rants of a Strength and Conditioning Madman. If you have not read that, read Rants of a Strength and Conditioning Madman. But Kurt is now at University of Houston. He was at Tulane, and I think was at Louisiana State, and then Tulane, and then is now at Houston. And he's a real good strength coach. But in the book, one of the things that he talks about is you need to know your kids. You need to know what their drivers are. And he talked about with his kids, what he wants to know is, he actually gives him a questionnaire. One of the things he said, who's the most important person in your life? And he needs to figure out, hey, is that your dad? Is that your mom? Is that your grandfather? Is that your grandmother? Like, who do you live with? Who raised you? How many parents do you have? Like, all those things are going to come into, they're going to be big players in your developing a relationship with that person. And I've told this story a bunch of times, but when I worked for the Red Sox, I read the media guide every day during spring training because I wanted to know as much as I could about everybody that I was dealing with. Were they married? Did they have kids? Where did they grow up? Did they go to college? Did they come out of, you know, did they sign out of high school? What was their situation prior so that I'd have a better ability to relate to those people? And I think we spend way too much time on the periodization stuff and the X's and O's and all this stuff, and probably not nearly enough time on the psychological part of the profession and realizing that, okay, I'm big on music. Okay. For instance, in our weight room, like you can't have music where there are swears. There's no obscenities allowed. Doesn't happen. I'm real big on shirts. Okay. You can't lift with your shirt off. There are just things I don't lift. Like in our situation, you can't wear headphones. You can't wear gloves. You can't have ear pods in. I think that you are trying to create a culture, particularly with kids, where they understand what the expectation is. And I think a lot of coaches do a really, really poor job of that. Sometimes I'll walk into weight rooms and look and think, like, my God, like whenever I see people post the Twitter stuff with the kids all lifting with their shirts off, I'm just like, this is so, it's incredibly unprofessional and sexist. Because your girls can't lift with their shirts off, right? Why would you possibly let the boys lift with their shirts off? Like, why would you do that? Okay, just everybody wears a shirt. That's the way that it works. Like in our situation, you can't wear just a sports bra. So, you know, we're not like typical 24-hour fitness. We don't have women running around in sports bras, and we don't have guys running around in tank tops. It's like everybody's got, you know, and again, the women, it gets a little bit now, you know, with some of the newer Lululemon stuff, you know, the definition of sports bra is probably a little bit different than it was 10 years ago for us. But we still, and especially with the kids, we enforce things like shorts. You know, we tell the girls the shorts have to cover their ass. We tell the boys the shorts have to be pulled up. Like those are all, you know, there's lots of non-negotiables about how we're going to conduct ourselves. And that stuff makes a big difference.
Coach,
sorry, I interrupted, but I know you guys had another question.
Just wanted to add another great book that I'm sure you've read is Conscious Coaching by Brett Bartholomew.
Yes. I am proud to say that four of the chapters in Conscious Coaching were written by MBSC employees. If you go and look through there and realize that Brendan Rierick and Kyle Holland, I'm trying to think who the other two are, but I'm pretty sure there were four of the chapters that, because he kind of alternated chapters with people. Yeah. So a bunch of our guys actually participated in that book.
Awesome book.
I like Conscious Coaching from a coaching standpoint because Brett was very, and I've said this to him directly, he was very open about his personal situation, which really made the book for me because, I think transparent is an overused word, but he was super transparent about the fact that, hey, I had problems when I was a kid and, you know, that related to exercise. And I won't spoil the book for people, but it was, that's really what made the book for me was his ability to kind of lay it out there early on, which I think makes a lot of other people feel like, hey, I can be successful even though maybe my teens weren't perfect.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, Coach, the X's and O's stuff is awesome. And you know, we could talk that all day, but just wanted to throw this kind of last question out there. There's plenty of coaches, again, as seasoned as you are, that have rode off into the sunset. What keeps you active? What keeps you going? Why are you still doing this?
Lack of a horse, probably. I just can't find a way to ride off into the sunset. But no, I really like what I'm doing. And I'm trying to kind of semi-retire, but I won't ever. I love doing stuff like this. My father was a high school principal, career kind of educator. I like doing this. I don't see myself disappearing. I will be on the gym floor significantly less probably as the years go on, but I will continue to – I'll coach every day if there's people around to coach. I like it. It's I don't want to be fully retired. I also don't want to work 8 or 10 or 12 hours a day anymore on the floor coaching group after group. So the nice thing about having your own business is you can kind of – again, you can, as we talked about, you can surf it a little bit in terms of, hey, I'll work a little bit more in the summer. I really like, it's great when my son and his friends are around. Okay, I got a group. I can coach those guys. When our pro guys come back in the summer, I can work with those guys. When our girls come back from the PWHL, I'll work with those groups. Like I'll spend time with the groups that I really want to spend time with, but I don't have any obligations. So it's kind of a nice mix in that way.
I love a story you told on a podcast of you walked in, you were saying to a girl like, hey, do it this way. Some guy in cutoff and flip-flops was telling me, I had a sweatshirt and flip-flops was telling me I need to do this, and your trainer's like, oh yeah, that he owns this place, that's Mike Boyle. Yeah, it's so funny. Exactly. We'll post it and all that, but Coach, what are your Twitter and Instagram handles for everybody out there?
So Twitter, I am mboyle1959. And Instagram, I am Michael_Boyle1959.
And hopefully everyone would agree of those are mandatory follows just for all the years of experience. But again, too, you call out the BS, you highlight the things that make sense or are, let's just say, relevant in terms of training, not just, random internet stuff. So Coach, for the impact you've made on my life, for Ross's and for Blair's, for the thousands of coaches, the hundreds of thousands of athletes, just thank you. I know like you're probably out of your mind, bored right now of constantly getting flattered nonstop, but you've taken a lot of crap over the years for stuff that you've put out there, and hopefully more and more people could come to grips in terms with like, yeah, he was right. But thank you again so much for today.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Victory Over Self Radio. Episodes are available anywhere you listen to podcasts. We also have videos and clips of each episode on our Victory Over Self Radio YouTube channel. Like and subscribe and let us know if there's any person or topic you'd like us to cover. See y'all next time.